Welcome back to Leaders Huddle. We are fired up today to interview a very dynamic leader, Mike Irwin, about the concepts in his recently published book, Lead Yourself First. Mike, a major in the Army Reserves, is the founder of two successful nonprofits, Team Red, White, and Blue, as well as a Positivity Project. In this conversation, we dive into how practicing solitude and reflection is an essential practice for leading effectively in today's hyper-connected world. We also talk about how Mike adapted leadership competencies he learned from his time on active duty into the nonprofit sector. This is an absolute can't-miss episode for leaders at every level in the Army. Before we get started, I must insert this disclaimer. Cowdall and the United States Military Academy do not officially endorse the nonprofit organizations discussed in this interview. The views and opinions discussed are those of the host and guests. They do not constitute the position of the United States Military Academy or the United States Army. Now let's jump into today's conversation with Mike Irwin. So Mike, what was your inspiration for writing a book on solitude and reflection, how they relate to leadership?
It actually started with a speech that was given at West Point back in 2009 by a guy named Bill Dershowitz. And in his speech, he talked about the power of solitude and really its role in clarity and sometimes being nonconformist as a leader. And so that was back in 2010 that speech turned into an article in the American Scholar. I read that article and actually reached out to Bill Dershowitz and told him about what an incredible article and what a speech he gave. And in talking to him, he really explained how deeply he believed in it, but that he was not interested in writing a book on the topic because he was already working on another book. And he suggested that if I was interested in reading a book on the topic of solitude's role in leadership and nonconformity, that I should look into writing that book myself. So that began this journey of about the past 6 or 7 years when we began researching, talking to a lot of people, especially people in leadership positions, and then reading about historical leaders to bring them together into this narrative, what has become the book called Lead Yourself First.
And we'll be sure to link the article and video onto our show notes. So it sounds like it gave you a challenge, and I'm curious to hear how you grew as a leader during the process of research, the interviews, and writing the book.
It was definitely quite the journey of perseverance. I will tell you that I had heard from a lot of people about how challenging it is to write a book, and I really learned that in practice over the past 6 years with Lead Yourself First. First of all, you have to gain clear vision on what the purpose of the book is. And then after you gain that vision, you have to be able to do all the work necessary to have enough analysis to be worth writing a book about. And then, of course, you have to figure out how you can frame all of that in a way that will convince a publisher that this is worth writing an entire book about. And so through that whole process, it was a lot of successes and failures. And again, one of the biggest leadership lessons I've learned is this notion that anything good is not going to be easy. Anything worth your time, you know, is going to require a lot of perseverance and to really stick with it, because what seems like a failure is actually just a setback that helps you see something more clearly. And I learned that lesson time and time again working with my co-author, Judge Ray Kethledge, on this book.
And if I recall, seeing it was a 7-year process from start to finish?
Yeah, absolutely. So first began in April of 2010, and the manuscript was due in June of 2016. So it was 6 years and 2 months. And then it's been a 1-year process of finalizing the manuscript, reviewing it, editing it, and then the process leading up to publication. So it's a little over 7 years since I first read that article by Bill Dershowitz, and that we've done all the research and all the writing and all the analysis in that time.
That's incredible. So I want to transition a little bit to talking to our junior leaders out there who are really busy leading their formations, often spending a lot of energy and time putting out fires and focused on the tyranny of the urgent. So solitude is not very synonymous with the demands on junior leaders today. I'd like to ask if you can offer some advice on how junior leaders can find margin in their life, both professionally and personally, to have a practice of solitude and reflection.
Absolutely. And somebody as myself, who is a very strong extrovert and, you know, has a lot going on, both in my personal and professional life, like a majority of all of us out there today who are working so hard to make a difference, I'll tell you that the solitude practice, you know, for me is ultimately targets of opportunity. this book does not espouse, nor do I think it's realistic for most of us to become Henry David Thoreau and go out to the mountains for days at a time. What is practical, though, is the small decisions we make throughout the day and how we spend those pockets of time. When we are driving into work in the morning, when we have the opportunity to go for a run with people or on our own, whether or not we can just, sometimes it takes us 5 or 10 minutes to step back from all the noise of the day to just quietly reflect. So the book articulates the message that solitude is not about these big periods of isolation. While it can be, and that's great, but if that's not realistic, especially as a junior leader, what is important is that you systematically integrate pockets of time in the day when you're detached from your cell phone, when it's just you and the ideas, it's just you and the big decision that you need to make. And we can all do that. No matter how busy you are, there's time in a day to do that. You just have to make it a priority. And that's one of the first things that the book talks about, is how important it is to make solitude a priority. And that if you don't do that, then it's not going to happen by osmosis. It's not going to just happen. You've got to, in today's world, with all the inputs and all the things coming at us and all the stimuli, you need to make it a priority. And that's the intent of the book, is to build a case and to argue that it is worth your time to find those pockets of 10 minutes here, 15 minutes there, 5 minutes there, 30 minutes, right? And so the aggregate of those pockets of uninterrupted time can add up to an hour, hour and a half in a given day. And that can be plenty of time in solitude to gain clarity and conviction for the big leadership decisions you need to make.
That's awesome. I always remember, I mean, I still do, like, work through lunch a lot of time, and there's some sort of pressure that you feel like you have to get so much done. And I would almost look down upon the guys who would go eat lunch in their car, and maybe they're actually just trying to find some solitude and reflection time. So you get that hour lunch break, that may be some time, you know, some time to do it. My follow-up question comes from a quote or a part in the book where you have, when you interviewed Brigadier General Tired Prince, in explaining the bias in leadership towards action and extroversion and against solitude. And I've talked about this extroversion bias with some of my more introverted and quiet cadets to just make them aware that I think, especially in the military, there's a sort of bias towards extroverted leaders, as maybe they're more effective, or in reality, they're just the more vociferous when explaining their ideas. So long roundabout way to answer your pretty simple question: why is it so important for us to stop during tense moments, examine the environment and situation in order to collect ourselves?
Yeah, that's a great question. And one that, talking to, at the time he was then Captain Prince in Vietnam in 1968, if you read the book, you'll hear his story. It's fascinating to see how in the moment, how he was so wrapped up and caught up in the emotions, and it took him stepping back from it and literally just pacing around for 20, 25, or 30 minutes on his own. And I think that ultimately, when you look at the neuroscience behind the brain, and you look at what happens with the endocrine system, and it dumps in all these hormones, and when you're in a moment of rage or in a moment of frustration or panic or whatever it might be, what is actually going on with the body, it really dilutes our capacity to make solid decisions. And actually, an interesting connection point here is that, you know, General Eisenhower is famous for saying, make big decisions in the calm. And so whether it's a big decision you have to make or in the moment and you need a decision in the next 20 minutes or 30 minutes or less, I think there's real power in stepping back and just composing yourself and trying to make sure that you are thinking deliberately about what you're going to decide. And there's power in following your gut or your intuition. However, I think that in many cases that we actually need to step back and make sure that if we are talking about our intuition, that we are quieting our mind enough that we're actually listening to our intuition and not just some alternative version of our intuition. So, you know, I really do believe that it is a biological process, that in those stressful moments that our decision-making ability is often hindered, and so therefore stepping back and creating that quiet space, like General Prince did and like so many other leaders that we interviewed and talked to did, to make sure that you're making the best possible decision you can make as a leader, because in many ways that's what leadership boils down to: decisions. Are you making good decisions or bad ones? Good ones or great ones? And the great leaders just consistently make good or great decisions, especially in chaotic times.
Man, that's so great. One of my personal sort of affinities for research right now is learning about neuroscience, how taking care of your body can make you give you more clarity in making those important decisions, ultimately make it more effective leader. And I've referenced this book a couple times, or actually listened to an audiobook. It's by it's called Eat, Move, Sleep by Tom Rath, and he did a lot of research on just the simple daily healthy habits and why the hell, you know, how they make you more healthy and overall effective leader. So I'm going to transition a little bit, give a good segue, because you talked about stepping back and making those important decisions. I think sometimes in the military especially in the Army, there's this sort of implied pressure to always be accessible, whether it's through cell phone or just at work all the time, until the work is done. So we understand that being accessible and having open door policy is important as a leader, but how can leaders balance being accessible with prioritizing time for solitude and detaching?
Yeah, so this is a tough one, especially in the world today, 2017. I like to joke about that there was once a time when we actually used to get excited about getting email, you know, AOL, but you got mail, right? And it's fascinating because now, you know, it is called the tyranny of email. And when you look at a lot of the data around email today, the analysis makes it clear that the average American in the workforce is addicted to their email. And we really struggle to be able to untether ourselves from our phone because email is now mobile. That's a relatively recent phenomenon. It's only been about the past 6-7 years when you've been able to really access your email consistently and effectively from your mobile device. Before that, you had to be logged into a computer. You had to be somewhere and actually intently seeking out to log into your email. I think that's a big deal because, you know, this is an experiment that we don't have a long enough sample size yet to really look at the long-term effects of this. And the addiction to email is very problematic because it's always there. And people can sort of feel like, hey, I'm being really efficient when I'm answering emails at, you know, 11 o'clock at night or when I'm up in the morning. And sometimes maybe you are being efficient, but very often as leaders, there needs to be a time for you to turn it off, just from the impact of like the restorative effect that it has on your brain, but also just from a basic emotional energy level. You need to be able to put down some of the challenges you face as a leader to give your body and brain that space to recover. So, you know, I think that when you look at having the open door policy, when you think about checking your email, certainly you need to have all that. You need to be accessible. However, I think that the society in general, I think leaders have really gotten caught up in what I would refer to evocatively as a tsunami of change in terms of the digital landscape in the digital world over the past, you know, 6 to 8 years, since mobile data has become so much cheaper and so much more available, and technology has become cheaper, and we can get iPhones and all these things. So I think that there will become an emerging social norm in the coming years when there's going to start to be the pendulum swing, and people are going to realize, like, wow, I really need to give myself space from all this. And that might mean policies that come down, you know, that, hey, no checking your email after 9 o'clock. Like, if it's really important, you'll get a call in the middle of the night, right? But if it's not, you can see it the next morning when you wake up or you come into the office. And I think that, you know, we're going to see some of those changes where, you know, yes, when you're in work and have the open door and people can come in and talk to you, that people will actually take advantage of that time versus emailing you at 10:30 at night and asking you a question when they could actually ask it in person in the day. Very few things are literally that urgent, you know, unless you're in combat or downrange, you know, when someone's life is on the line, that you need an answer at 10:30 at night versus the next morning. It can wait. And I think that we're going to see that trend, you know, start to change and shift back to a level that is more sustainable for leadership and for life, work, balance, you know, in the future.
Yeah. You don't directly talk about it, but I think you're getting around to the importance of having wake-up criteria and CCIR and understanding as a leader those decisions that only you can make, while powering down and having decentralized command, empowering your subordinates so they can take care of everything. And so I think you're getting at trying to break that myth or perception about leading. There's that perception that when you're in a leadership role that you have to have all the answers or you need to know everything, and really you're withholding power, not spreading it out. And I think that takes away from the effectiveness of your organization and the growth of others. Did you want to touch on that or elaborate anything on that?
Yeah, no, I would say that's spot on. I think that again, because of the constant accessibility that we have in the world today, leaders have access to a lot more information than they ever had before. And that can be a good thing, but it can also be very problematic, because unless you empower people to make those decisions and they feel like everything has to sort of funnel through you as a leader, all you're doing is putting more and more information and more decisions onto your plate, which you can be, then become, you know, a bottleneck and actually slow down the agility and the flexibility of your organization. And what we know is one of the real benefits of a startup nonprofit or a startup company or a small unit like a Special Forces A-team is agility. Like, the agility is what allows you to be competitive against larger forces. It's the same thing in a counterinsurgency environment. It's what allows insurgent forces to be able to, you know, to attack and really cause problems for larger organizations. Agility is huge. And again, when it boils down to leadership today, very often with all these inputs and all this information coming in, very often what I see from leaders is that they've actually, not to their, and not by desire or by design, but they've become a bit of a bottleneck now, or the organization now has created bottlenecks because everyone wants to have access to all the information. And sometimes that's just not the most effective way of operating.
Going back in the book a little bit, in chapter 6, it's about emotional balance. And on that topic in decision-making, you guys write that judgment is the process of weighing competing interests, and the leader who comes to that process with equanimity puts no emotional distortion of his own upon the scale. Can you elaborate on how solitude can improve our judgment?
So when you look at emotional balance, and part of my story in the book is profiled in this portion of the book, the big thing we see is the need to be able to control the ill effects when, especially when adversity or challenge breaks upon the scene. Because what we know from interviewing so many great leaders is that when things happen in the immediacy of it, or when you're close to it, or when you're either in close in space or time to a challenge or something that arises, what we see is that our judgment is clouded, because we see the problem as being bigger most of the time than what it is. We see it as being more complex than what it is. And by stepping back and creating that space, and to calm down and to step back and say, okay, hey, here's the bigger picture, you can now look at the other factors. And first and foremost, realize that very rarely is a problem as bad an hour later as it seems like when it first hits. You know, when it first hits, it just, most problems seem like, oh boy, that's a big problem. And so I think it's important to realize that when we give ourselves that space and allow our emotions to calm down, that can really help our clarity of mind. And just think about this in terms of an email. Like, if you get an email that makes you upset or frustrates you or something like that, and like, you, if you immediately respond, your emotions are wound up in that response, right? In your decision to make a response that's just not very effective. Whereas, and so I've, like, for several years now, I've created this policy with myself that anytime I get an email or a post on social media that is offensive to me or criticizes my character or criticizes, you know, a leadership decision I've made, I just step away from it and walk, and I would never respond, you know, for quite a long time. And if you look, and we talk about this in the book, but if you look at President Abraham Lincoln, one of the things that he did, he had written a letter to General Meade, you know, when Meade had Lee's forces up against the river, and at following Gettysburg, and didn't do anything about it. And Lincoln never sent that note. General Eisenhower, same thing. He wrote a lot of letters to himself or, to his wife, and never publish them or show them to, you know, any of his generals or things like that. But it was just this way of, like, getting the emotions out of your mind and, you know, down on paper, or, you know, get them out without actually distributing them to people who you lead. And I think there's real power in that idea of getting your emotions out, and then it helps you to see more clearly, and it also, you know, gives you a release valve for the negative effects of your emotions.
The save and draft function on Outlook is pretty useful. Yeah. I know this is a message that I've heard a lot, and I saw it on SportsCenter once. It was like Herm Edwards talking about never send an email or post on Facebook or social media when you're angry. And of all places, you know, sports having that type of context, it's a pretty good message. And that's so great, Mike. I do that a lot now, of having the maturity now to save something in a message form and be like, what am I even saying here? And just deleting the email and going back and maybe having that conversation in person, or just letting it go, honestly. So one person you profile in the book at the time, he was General Mattis, in charge of, he was the commander for CENTCOM, and he's featured a lot in this chapter. Now he's Secretary of Defense Mattis. What did you learn from interviewing him?
Yeah, I learned a lot. So I spoke to him for about 40 minutes when he was en route on his military plane to the Middle East. And as you might imagine, the guy's the real deal. You know, you see a lot of the memes out there and a lot of things talking about, you know, Mattis, and he is the real deal with his thought process. One of the things I learned was how deeply he believes in his conviction about the importance that a leader read, and that he or she read about history, so that you can put yourself in someone else's shoes and then use that knowledge to help you to make decisions today. And so that was a big one in terms of that. But really, his whole push on equanimity and on the warrior who is most successful in battle is the one who is placid. Like, he really emphasized the importance of when the bullets are flying and when times are the most chaotic and stressful, that is when it's especially important for solitude to do its work. And he talked about it in terms of preparation. So before you're going into combat, before you're going into it, and he really talked about this all through the military lens. He didn't try to take it out of the military context at all. He talked about, for military leaders, preparatory solitude is huge to help you be able to respond effectively in the moment when the bullets are flying. And he talked a lot about the role of emotional balance, and that a leader's got to remain calm, and that when those bullets are flying and people around you are nervous and people around you are scared, that they're looking to their leader, on the ground, and how is he or she responding in that moment. And so his emphasis around solitude was really centered a lot around grounding yourself emotionally so that you're prepared. And then when in the moment, kind of like General Prince talks about, in those moments that you have the knowledge and you've got the tool in your toolkit to sort of pull out and to practice that solitude in the moment to calm yourself down. So it was a fascinating discussion we had with him.
To me, it sounds like a lot of like visualizing the battle before it happens, or visualizing yourself inside combat before it happens. And I'm a huge history buff, studied Chamberlain as one of my heroes of the Civil War, and there's two or three occasions throughout his career after Gettysburg where he was credited with single-handedly changing the sway of combat by his presence and remaining calm. And the guy was shot six times, lived till like 84, became a governor of Maine. Just incredible leader. So Mike, I'm curious, and you talked about, you're a big fan of running, obviously. That's a lot of how Team RWB was started. What does your solitude practice look like outside of running? And when you are reflecting, I'm curious of learning your sort of catalyst or call to action. When do you feel strong conviction to, now that you've done the reflection, to act?
Yeah, so I think for me, solitude is, and like it is for a lot of people, it's one, it's challenging. Just because I've co-authored a book on it doesn't mean that it comes any easier for me, or that I believe it any more fervently than I think a lot of listeners out there. So I think that, naturally, running for me has become a big way that I have practiced solitude. As you mentioned, I've spent a lot of time on the power of clarity and achieving emotional balance. But I find a lot of it really in my personal life is in these moments of time I alluded to earlier, 5, 10, 15 minute pockets. When I'm at home, sometimes picking the weeds or mowing the lawn. When I'm at work, sometimes it's simple as closing the door if you've got one. And in my house, I work from home, so I literally close the door, and having the discipline to separate yourself from your phone and from your computer and just sit there and think. If you look back to people like Newton, when he the concept of gravity, it's not a surprise, he was sitting under a tree when the apple fell and hit him on the head, right? Albert Einstein was famous for, when he would get frustrated and not come up with the solution, he would literally sit there in his office and just lie on the floor and look up at the ceiling for hours at a time. And so some of the people who have seen the power of this, it's something that I've learned from just watching and what they did. And so sometimes it's literally closing the door and just sitting there and doing nothing. And sometimes it is all about hard work, and you sit there and you realize, hey, I really need a solution to this problem. We can't quite figure out the best way to do this, so I'm going to think really hard about this for the next 10 or 15 minutes and see if I can make any breakthrough ideas. And just like anything else, it's not wasted time, but sometimes it might feel like it's wasted time if you don't emerge with a clear decision or a breakthrough moment. Sometimes it's just an investment in the process. And again, I think it's really important as a leader that you invest in that process, because you have to develop that muscle to think on your own, to focus on your own. And the analogy I use is, it's a lot like trying to run, a 12-minute, 2-mile time on the APFD. If you don't run and you don't train that muscle and you don't train, you're not going to have the lungs, the heart, and the leg strength to make it happen if you just decide that I'm going to go out and do it. at least most of us don't, right? The reality is you have to train for it. And it's the same way. So if you want to focus and you want to have the capacity to think for yourself, as crazy as that sounds, we are now so guilty, a lot of us, as just going to Google for the answers, going to somebody else, emailing somebody. Just, you know, there's so many quick responses that we can have. So the idea of literally thinking for yourself is a skill set, and it's just like training a muscle. You've got to do it consistently, even though you're going to have some bad runs. You're going to have some runs when you feel like, wow, that was a complete terrible run. Same thing. You might have a 15 or 20 minute, you know, investment of solitude, and you emerge from it and, you know, actually more confused or more frustrated than before. And once again, I think it's important to be okay with that and just invest in that process, because over time, the iterative effect of that is going to be good.
It sounds a lot like the sort of meta skill of strategic thinking, where not necessarily coming to a solution, but just asking more questions. So I want to ask a little follow on to that. Do you engage in any like thought partnership where you're sharing some of your thoughts with certain really trusted people? Jim Collins calls it like a board of advisors, people that you really trust.
Absolutely. So I think one of the key things is, and one of the big things, the messages of Lead Yourself First, is that the power of the book and the power of leaders who lead themselves first is that you're actually showing up better and more effective for other people, because you're less distracted, you're less frazzled, you're more clear, you're more balanced, you have increased conviction. And that's the intent of it. So it's not enough to just come up with ideas on your own and then put them down in, you know, on a piece of paper or somewhere, but it's actually, how do you now take that and roll it into action, leadership action, that's going to have a positive effect on other people? So I certainly got a group of people who are senior mentors to me. You know, one of them is Jim Collins, you know, who I generally speak with, you know, a couple, two, three times a year. But also I've got a bunch of peers that I connect with, people who I do a lot of work on the Positivity Project with, Team Red, White, and Blue, authors, you know, so a lot of different people who I'll connect with and say, hey, I've just really thought about this and just curious, like, am I thinking about this right? And so it is, it's a tango, right? It's this leading yourself first, practicing solitude, but at the same time, emerging from that better and stronger with more clarity so that you can be a more effective leader.
Switching gears a little bit here, Mike, you're not only a writer, but you're the founder of two successful nonprofits. And what skill sets and competencies that you developed in the military have translated to success of both the Positivity Project and Team RWB?
A lot. You know, as an intelligence officer, part of my job was to analyze the various forms of information coming in, to assess validity, to assess, you know, assign weight to them, and then to be able to see as clearly as I could, you know, into the future, and make predictions and do predictive analysis that would be useful to the commander. And so that skill set of analyzing what you see and looking at all the flow of information and then stepping back and making sense of it was really critical to me as an entrepreneur, because in many ways that's what you have to do. You have to look and assess what domain you're in. Are you in the veteran space? Are you in the education space? You know, so Team Red, White, and Blue is a veteran support nonprofit, and the Positivity Project, we partner with schools. So very different segments of the population. So I think you have to achieve clarity on understanding that. And again, as an entrepreneur, that knowledge becomes really important to be able to see the picture clearly and to try to do the predictive analysis. And frankly, even in my opinion, even creating an organization that will address needs that are emerging. So when you look at Team Red, White, and Blue, you know, there was really very few veteran support nonprofits that were focused on empowering veterans to live happier, more physically healthy lives, right? And so I saw that in those early days, and a lot of us started to see that and realize, like, wow, we have the opportunity to really become the leading physical fitness / community connection nonprofit organization for veterans. So, you know, and then even here in terms of the Positivity Project, if I had, you know, started this 8 years ago, I don't think it would have been nearly as timely or relevant. But the idea of leaving a job to create the Positivity Project is very clearly as looking at the landscape of education today and the challenges that our youth face, and the fact that social emotional learning and character strength education is especially important right now for the future of our democracy. And so the timeliness of creating an organization is also very important. And again, that I was able to do that in part because of the skill sets that I developed in the military, of looking at the whole landscape, is trying to see, like, how is Iran influencing in Afghanistan, and what's the weather and the terrain, and you have to analyze a whole bunch of stuff and make sense of it at the end of the day. And that really is what, you know, I've done in, you know, in both nonprofits.
You're kind of talking about like systems level thinking a little bit. Got a few rapid fire questions as we come up on our time limit. I want to ask specifically, what's your favorite book on leadership or military history? I know it's hard to pin down a favorite book. Maybe you got a couple. I'm just curious, what does Mike Irwin read?
Yeah, so I think for me, you know, when it comes to military history, there's a whole bunch to choose from. You know, I think my, you know, my favorite books kind of go back to the Civil War, Battle of Gettysburg, you know, books about them, about that battle. But I also think for me, really, when it comes to what am I reading, I alluded to before, is, you know, two books that I recommend to everybody. And number one is Man's Search for Meaning by Viktor Frankl. You know, he was a survivor of the Holocaust and some of the most dire conditions, and he looked at and then tells the story of the Holocaust and man's search of meaning and purpose through the lens of a psychiatrist, somebody who studied the, you know, the human brain and the human condition. And then also is a it's a fiction book, but it feels very much like nonfiction, and that's called The Alchemist by Paulo Coelho. And I read that book about once a year, and it's a quick read, and both books are relatively short. And, you know, The Alchemist moves along pretty quickly, whereas Viktor Frankl's work is very emotional and difficult to read. And so you have to, I think, digest that one a little slower. But The Alchemist is powerful, and it really gives you that perspective of everything in life happening for a purpose and for a reason. And as a leader and someone who's making lots of decisions and affecting lots of people's lives, that's a really reaffirming message to hear.
So that's like the third, fourth time I've heard both books recommended. So I think that's a subliminal message to me to get to buy those books and read them. All right, last couple questions. So what's next on the horizon in terms of the book, and how can our listeners find the book online?
So yeah, so right now doing a lot of talking about it on podcasts, and being interviewed in articles and talking about it. So I'll be speaking, doing an LPD at the Pentagon sometime in the fall. Be coming back here actually to West Point and talking to the athletic department and to the team captains, and hopefully to the behavioral sciences and leadership department. So excited to share the message with military leaders. And then I am doing a fair amount out there with some various units. I did some work with the 3rd Infantry Division, you know, Special Forces groups, U.S. Army Special Operations Command. So there's, I think, a very strong applicability of this message to people in the military. Beyond that, you know, doing a lot of talking at schools and at, you know, associations that focus on principles. And then people can find the book. You know, you can go to your local bookstore. It's there, Barnes & Noble. And then, of course, on Amazon, you can go and pick up the book there as well.
How can our listeners connect with you on social media?
Yeah, so part of the interesting thing about social media is, you know, just co-authored a book that talks about the power of focus and the problem with distractions. And so, interestingly enough, for those who know me, I'm very active on social media. I just use it very intently, and I also limit my time there. But, you know, I'm on LinkedIn, and I'm on Instagram, and I'm on Twitter. You know, so Erwin RWB, so E-R-W-I-N. RWB is my Twitter and my Instagram handle, and people can find me there. And I post a lot about the book, but also positive psychology and Team Red, White, and Blue, and everything that I'm involved in. So both of those locations.
Mike, thanks for your time. I've really been, you know, when we looked at starting up this podcast, you were one of the first guys I actually contacted on getting some advice. And this was after I had interviewed you for one of our papers during grad school. So thank you for your time and sort of your support for our message and giving you a little bit of a platform to talk about the book. I read it in a few days, and I was like highlighting every single page, thinking this is the exact book I needed in my time in my season of life. If you go pick it up on Amazon, I think most people can get through it in a long weekend, and it's got such an incredible message. Thanks again, and hopefully we can connect with you again in the future.
Yeah, absolutely. It's really great to be able to share the message of the book with especially all the leaders out there in the Army who are tuned into this, and look forward to hearing from people and their thoughts about it, and hopefully it is both convincing and inspiring. And thanks again.
So I'm going to close the show with a quote. Haven't done it in a while, but I saw this, and it's by Secretary Mattis. An effective leader is the person who can maintain their balance and reflect when a lot of people around them are reacting. All right, this wraps up episode 28. Be sure to check out our next episode, where we interview a prolific military blogger on the place that humor and satire have in leadership. Do us a favor and share this episode and the podcast with a friend. Word of mouth is the best way to pay it forward and to spread this free resource. You can subscribe on Apple iTunes and Google Play. See you next time on the Leaders Huddle podcast. We'll be right back. The views expressed in the Leaders Huddle podcast are the opinions of the hosts and guests. The discussion shared here does not represent the official position of the United States Military Academy or the U.S. Army.